Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest today is Sydney-based peace activist Donna Mulhern, an author, a former journalist and a political advisor. She was a human shield in the war in Iraq in 2003, and she later returned to Iraq as a humanitarian aid worker. She was part of an international team of volunteers that established a small non-government organization, Our Home Iraq, which set up a shelter for street kids in Baghdad, a center for traumatized children, and provided emergency aid to displaced families. During this time, she witnessed the massacre of Fallujah in April 2004, survived constant bombing, being kidnapped by fighters, and being shot at by American soldiers. In 2004-05, Donna spent 4 months in the West Bank of Palestine as a volunteer in the International Solidarity Movement. During those years, she continually wrote reports and reflections called Pilgrim Notes, which were distributed widely around Australia and the world. Donna Mulhern, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Donna, okay, so let's talk first about the massacre of Fallujah. I want you to give some background to the audience about what happened, why America massacred Fallujah, how many people there were, who fled, and what happened, please.
Okay, so we need to go back to April 2004, when the first attack on Fallujah occurred, and then the second attack was November 2004. But of course, there's always a bigger story to these things. So in terms of the mainstream media, they would have reported the attacks having just began then in April, that there weren't problems in the city. But actually, it's interesting to discuss the context of those attacks. In terms of the mainstream media, the story of Fallujah began when three, they're called security contractors, working for Blackwater Corporation, drove into Fallujah City, armed to the hilt with their machine guns, looking like Rambos, etc., and they were hijacked and killed, and their bodies were burned and then hung from a bridge in Fallujah. So there was outrage in the United States following this incident, and the images of those bodies hanging from the bridge were beamed across the world, but particularly reported over and over again in the United States media. Little explanation, of course, given as to why they were there, that they were securities contractors working for Blackwater Corporation. So the first attack on Fallujah was very much a knee-jerk response in terms of an act of collective punishment following that incident. The attacks began within days of those images being broadcast through the United States. But this was against the recommendation of the military there at the time. The Marines who were based there at the time actually feared what would happen if there was a harsh response immediately. What they preferred was to have a criminal investigation to find those who committed the crime and have a trial. And that was their recommendation. Mm. But by this stage, the media in the United States had gone crazy, and there had been calls by commentators all over the United States to flatten the city, to raise the city, to bomb it into history, to teach them a lesson. And, of course, that hysteria made its way to those at the White House, and therefore it was actually Donald Rumsfeld who stepped in. He intervened into the military response and demanded a fierce attack on Fallujah, and George Bush agreed with him. So against the recommendation of the military in Fallujah, the political instruction was to go in and finish them off and to punish this city. And, of course, it had a reputation of a high level of insurgents and resistance activity. And that was probably because just months earlier, US troops had fired openly on a crowd of people who were demonstrating the occupation of their school by US forces. About 60 civilian people were killed in that massacre. This is rarely reported, this context, to this to these attacks on Fallujah. So the attacks in April were fierce, and they included air attacks as well as so aerial bombardment of the city, as well as house-to-house raids, as well as snipering. So the city was cut off. Nobody was allowed in and nobody was allowed out. I was in Baghdad at the time, living in Iraq and working in Baghdad, and me and my friends, we were independent human rights activists, we got phone calls from doctors in Fallujah, and the doctors said to us, you've got to come here and see this. You've got to help us, they said, because they're shooting at us. We said, well, how could they shoot at you? You're doctors. And they said, not only that, they're shooting our children. They're just shooting the children. And we said, our reaction was disbelief. We said, oh, calm down. Like, don't exaggerate. You know, how can we respond if you're being dramatic? And they said, well, come and see. So we made the decision, a small group of us, internationals from England, America, Australia, we snuck in to the city while it was under attack, and what we saw then was horrific. And we were, by the way, one of only six foreign eyewitnesses to this because the US military had not allowed any journalist into the city. So then what we saw was quite horrific. Fallujah City Hospital was the first building to be taken. It was shut down and the doctors were arrested, and they were arrested because they had been reporting civilian casualties to the media. So they wanted that shut down. No Iraqi person was allowed to be treated at Fallujah Hospital, only US soldiers.
Really?
Yes. That had an extremely terrible impact, as you could imagine, on the civilian population. So what we had then was terrible wounds caused by the snipering and the bombing, and these people were not able to get the treatment that could have saved them. So I did volunteer work at this clinic where the doctors set up makeshift beds and surgeries. That where I was, they kept the blood in a Coke machine. They had no anaesthetic. And when there was no electricity, people would gather around the surgery table holding up cigarette lighters to provide illumination.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then the bodies were just coming and coming and coming, those who were injured. And it was just unbelievable to see so much carnage. If I hadn't have seen it myself, I would barely believed it. What was most shocking was the bodies of the children. So we saw small children with gunshot wounds straight through the head.
My God.
Yes, this strategy they had of snipering was quite diabolical. Their orders, we were told later, was to shoot anything that moved, and that was exactly what they did.
Is
and they
that
followed
right?
it precisely. So they had snipers stationed on the rooftops of mosques and houses, and they were up high, and they were aiming down, and if there were any movement on the street by any person, that person would be shot. And the bodies we just saw of women, grandmothers, small children, obviously civilians who were just trying to make their way around the city. There was just so many. And then after a few days, there was a decision made to dig up Fallujah Soccer Stadium because the cemetery had overflowed with so many fresh graves that there was nowhere left to bury the bodies. So this was the first attack. And mind you, as this was happening, outside of Iraq, there was very little outrage. There was very little response, possibly because there wasn't widespread media coverage. At this stage, we just had Al Jazeera in there and some other Arab network trying to get the word out.
So the US media was not attending to this, Donna Mulhern?
They were not embedded at this point in the first attack on Fallujah. The US military were not embedded. And so they were only getting their information secondhand, coming out from the US military spokespeople at their press conferences, etc. So it was up to Iraqis on the ground and Iraqi journalists and Arab journalists and us who were in there to try to get the word out and the images. So I have a collection of images from this that we tried to distribute. So the outrage did come from within Iraq, though. The Iraqi population were just horrified by what was happening to this city. It was the most intense attacks of the war so far, since the initial campaign in 2003. So Iraqi people were sending convoys of food and aid from all over Iraq to help the community in Fallujah. The outrage got so extreme that the Iraqi government put pressure on the US military to end the campaign.
And how long did this thing go on for, this killing and slaughter in Fallujah in April 2004?
By the time the pressure had been put on the military and the military started to retreat, it had been about 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Yeah, and so eventually the US military did retreat because of that pressure from the Iraqi government.
And how many people were killed in that 2 weeks?
In that 2 weeks, it would be, the estimates are between 1,000 to 1,500.
And I heard that the population of Fallujah was about 250,000 and they were warned and people fled. Is that untrue?
There were some warnings before the attacks began, but for a city of that size, so a reasonably large city, it obviously wasn't enough time for all people to get out in time. It was only really 24 hours. And many people who I asked, you know, did you leave Fallujah? Were you there? Many people said, well, I had to stay because I had nowhere else to go.
Mm, mm.
So for many, there wasn't an option to leave. But I can recount one particularly horrifying event that happened to us when I was leaving Fallujah after my days there. And this is after we'd been shot at and we'd been harassed by soldiers just for trying to deliver the aid, etc. When we tried to leave the city, there were checkpoints, and because the city was encircled and the checkpoints were all closed. So the checkpoint we went to, there was about, I don't know, probably about 200 cars full of families of people just wanting to get out of Fallujah, just wanting to live, to survive this and to flee. And we were just astounded that these queues were going nowhere and that the checkpoint was shut. So we approached the soldiers at the checkpoint with our loudspeaker, with our hands in the air, and identified who we were. And they motioned to us to go through the checkpoint and to leave Fallujah. And we said, well, hang on a minute. That's okay for us. We said, but what about the 200 cars behind us packed full of families? And the soldiers said, well, they'll be staying where they are. And we said, you know, the city's under attack. The civilians being killed every day. These people need to get out. And the remarks we heard shock me to this day. Remarks about, basically, one man said, well, we want them all in there so we can finish them all off at once.
Oh, good.
That's a direct quote of a man looking in my face, looking me in the eye. So we refused to leave the issue, and we demanded that they follow the Geneva Convention. Mind you, they had very little recollection of the Geneva Conventions, but we insisted that the civilians be allowed to leave. It took us several hours before they agreed to allow women and children to leave. They announced and they thought that that was a great concession. So we said, well, of course, that's quite meaningless for many of them because many of the women don't drive. They need to stay with their husbands, et cetera, et cetera. So that's almost meaningless. And then after another couple of hours of cajoling, they agreed that the grandfathers could leave as well, the elderly, aged over 50. And so that meant that a few of the cars could get through, and those people were very, very grateful. But when we went back to report back to the young men, you could imagine the horror and the devastation for them. They were just saying, tell them we just want to leave. Tell them we don't want to hurt them. We don't want to fight them. We just want to survive this. These were young men who were, you know, school teachers and pharmacists and motor mechanics. They weren't fighters. So it was really, there was so much wrong with the rules of engagement. And there are no rules in war, really, what I've seen from the war zones I've been to. Everything is really thrown out the window.
Yeah.
And those who suffer the most are always civilians who were caught in the middle.
Now, Donna, I read that when they closed that hospital, the Fallujah Hospital, they also went in and shot the doctors and the patients on the operating tables. Was that an accurate report or not?
I, I don't know about patients. There may have been patients shot if they were deemed to have been fighters.
Mm-hmm.
So that would make sense. And I did hear, yes, that some doctors were killed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, now you went back again. They did it again in November. What? I don't understand why they went back in. No, the Americans went back in November to Fallujah.
They returned to Fallujah in November simply because they did not finish the job in April.
Well, what was the job they had to finish?
They wanted to, I'll use their terminology now, weed out the terrorists. They called Fallujah a terrorist nest, and they wanted to weed out all of the terrorists and to decapacitate them so that they were not able to continue their resistance. So they deemed that job was incomplete in April because they had been cut short by the Iraqi government.
Mm.
And then the word in the military circles was that the next campaign was being planned. It would be bigger and better and more ferocious, but they were given orders that it would not be allowed to start until after the presidential elections of that year. So they waited until after the presidential elections, and then in November 2004, the second attack on Fallujah was unleashed, and that one was called Operation Vigilant Resolve. Now, and that did finish the job. I'm just going to quote some facts and figures here. From the two attacks, it's estimated more than 2,000 civilians were killed, between 2,000 to 3,000. 36,000 homes were demolished, 9,000 shops, 65 mosques, 60 schools, the heritage building, and most government offices in the city. Human rights groups have documented the breach of more than 70 articles of the Geneva Convention. So what I've done in my research on Fallujah is compared these attacks to the ancient sacking of a city, if you can think of that image,
mm-hmm.
of having a city, smoke and ashes, and the enemy rides away and there's basically nothing left.
Mm.
So this is the image I think we can use for Fallujah. But then something even worse than that physical destruction is, of course, the impact and the legacy of the weapons that were used during those attacks. And now this is the issue that Fallujah has to deal with day to day, right now, many years later.
So before we get into that, so in toto, in Operation Vigilant Resolve, what a revolting term, what a revolting... Oh, words escape me. How many people did they kill in that November, just after George Bush was re-elected, in that November attack? How many civilians did they kill, Donna Mulhern?
In that attack, it's estimated, again, between 1,000 and 2,000 civilians.
So mostly they destroyed buildings, hospitals, schools and the like, and up to 2,000 civilians of a population of 250,000. So they must have been fairly careful in their targeting to make sure people were not in the schools at the time they bombed them, in the mosques.
Well, again, the order had been given before the attack began in November for people to leave the city.
Oh, that's right.
Yes,
so they did leave the city before this particular onslaught.
Yes, so more people were able to get out in November than were able to in April.
Yeah.
They had more warning.
Yeah.
And they had a taste of what was to come.
Yeah.
And so there were less civilians in the city in November.
So how long did this go on for, this slaughter? How long?
Again, that was about 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Okay, so let's get on to the weapons they used.
Okay, so it was alleged and initially denied, remarkably, but then, of course, accepted that the US used a chemical weapon that is banned, and that is white phosphorus. Now, the way they justified the use of white phosphorus is they said that they did not use it as a weapon, but that they used it as an illuminator. So what they mean by that is, because they were doing house-to-house fighting, they would throw a white phosphorus canister into a room before they would enter, a dark room, and that canister would illuminate the room so they could see who was in there. And whether
burn everyone in the room.
Pardon?
And burn everyone in the room.
Well, that was the thing. In the meantime, the flesh of every person in that room would have been eaten away by the impact of that chemical. So that was the way that they used white phosphorus, and they justified it as an illuminator. I have photos of bodies that were burnt by white phosphorus, and you've never seen anything like it. It's very unusual. It's quite eerie because often the clothes are intact, but the flesh is burnt.
And it burns right down to the bone.
Yes, and so this was used widely. And we still don't have any clear indications of the long-term impact of white phosphorus because there has not been a lot of research done on this. There is currently a doctor in Lebanon, a scientist, who is researching this issue, of course, because the other user of white phosphorus is the government of Israel, the Israeli Defense Forces, and they used white phosphorus in Gaza and the attacks in Lebanon.
We are
seeing the impacts, but in those places as well. But
I thought there was a ban on chemical weapons internationally.
Well, there is a ban on chemical weapons, but the way that they got around that was to say that it was not used as a weapon. That's the way they justified it. It was not used as a weapon.
Aren't they liars?
That's how they got away with it.
Okay, other weapons.
Well, of course, it's alleged that depleted uranium rounds were used in the attacks. Why? Well, because they were standard rounds used by the US Army at that time, and they had been used in other attacks around
Iraq. When you say
Iraq.
Rounds, were they bullets, anti-tank shells? What exactly?
It would be a mixture of those conventional weapons, so it would be tank shells, definitely. It would be bullets, and it would be other what they call bunker buster bombs, the powerful ones that they want to really destroy a building and flatten a building. And also in their armour, there's also their tanks that are armoured with depleted uranium to strengthen their tanks. So it would have been a mixture of their arsenal would have contained depleted uranium.
So how many, how much in terms of tonnage, and let's just call it uranium. I mean, the term depleted uranium is ridiculous.
Yes.
It just doesn't have uranium-235 in it, which is only, 0.7% of natural uranium anyway. So it's uranium-238 with a half-life of 4.5 billion years. So what total tonnage did they estimate that was used in Fallujah in November 2004, Donna Mulhern?
We don't know. We don't know because the US military has denied that they've used it. So, and we can't get reliable information on that at this point. So a Freedom of Information request was put into the US military on this issue, and the response back was that the official response was that no uranium weapons were used in the November attacks on Fallujah, and that in the April attacks that they have no records of the weapons that were
record.
Used.
Yeah, that's what they do.
Yeah. So there has been no official estimate or information given. So then, we haven't been able to gather reliable data from other sources. So
have people tested, gone in to test the dust and the like to see if there's uranium in it?
There has not been the opportunity. Okay, so following the attacks in November 2004, Fallujah has been in a state of chaos. And so you then had the city occupied, a brutal occupation by US forces, soldiers on every second corner pushing their machine guns into the faces of the community. And so the US forces did not allow or make any room for any scientific research, of course, because they've denied that there was a problem in the first place. And it was only since December last year that those troops have left.
So, is that right? So they were there for 7 years?
Yes. And that, again, the city had been surrounded by checkpoints all this time. The checkpoints were extremely, brutal in the words of the Fallujah people. They had one checkpoint they called the Checkpoint of Misery. All community members had to have the retina in their eyes scanned, and they could only get access into the city and out after going through these very strict checkpoints. And so you can imagine the disruption that caused to their lives on a daily basis, the humiliation, just the weight of having that military occupation around them at all times, and the US troops being trigger happy, like people were just afraid to put their hand in their pocket without having a gun in their
Do
face.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the Nazis.
Mm. So that's why in all those years when that would have been extremely important to do research and studies regarding the soil and to see what contaminants were there, that was not able to be done because of this continued state of military occupation and chaos. And so it's only since December last year that those troops have left. And still it's very difficult because Fallujah is still deemed to be one of the most violent cities in Iraq. It's still very difficult. When I was there, I needed to drive with a guard, an armed guard. The police want to give you convoys and protection, and it's still very difficult. So what we have in this story is this is where we have the gap, and the gap is in this the lack of this ability to have been able to do and the opportunity to do good research into what contaminants are there in that community.
Right. Okay, so let's get on to the next bit. What did you find? What are people reporting? What are the doctors and the paediatricians and obstetricians reporting in this population of Fallujah?
Okay, so what we have now in this city is a dramatic increase in the incidence of birth defects, miscarriages and stillborn births since 2004. So we have what is now 5 to 6 times the average in other comparable Middle Eastern cities around the region. We have...
In birth defects?
Yes.
Yep.
Yes. So speaking to the paediatrician at Fallujah Hospital, Dr. Samira, she's only one doctor who's taking records because for many years there were not records taken about this, and the information was not being collected in any way that was thorough or precise. But now she's doing that. She reports 1 to 2, she says about 30 babies born with serious defects per month. So that's at least one a day. That's about 700 a year. That's about 1/3 of all births. And that's live births and the baby being born with defects. That's not counting babies born dead and babies who didn't make it to full term, so miscarriages. So what we have now is Fallujah Hospital is overwhelmed with these problems, and some of the problems of the babies are quite complex. There's many congenital heart conditions. There's many problems with spina bifida issues. There's many neurological issues, and sometimes the doctors can't even figure out what's wrong. There's graphically, the babies are born quite deformed, but other times there's no visible defect, but the heart is the heart problems are extremely complex and will often mean the baby will die within several months afterwards. And mostly because they don't have the care that is required for such complex conditions.
Now, I heard that because the birth defects are 5 to 6 times above expected incidence with, you know, one a day, that the doctors in Fallujah have advised the women to stop having babies. Is that true, Donna Mulhern?
Yes, there's a gynecologist in Fallujah who treats the patients, and she is confronted with this on a daily basis. And her advice and the advice of other doctors in Fallujah, their official recommendation is just to stop falling pregnant. They say that it's unlikely that they will give birth to a healthy child. And at this stage, they say until they have solutions or they have adequate care, they say it's a risk. They warn the mothers. They say it's at your risk that you fall pregnant because it's possible that you won't have a healthy baby.
Okay, now let's move on to childhood cancers. What's the story about that in Fallujah, Donna Mulhern?
I don't have as much information about that as I've been focusing on the babies, and I don't know that anyone has been taking statistics on the cancers. Just to say that the paediatricians have noticed an increase, but there hasn't been as much documentation or records about that issue.
And I think it's important to tell the audience, and I mentioned it earlier in this interview, that the half-life of uranium-238, which is what makes what these weapons are composed of, is 4.5 billion years. So what the Americans and the Coalition of the Willing, and that's Australia and it may be Australian uranium, is doing is contaminating the cradle of civilization forevermore. So the fact that the women have been told to stop having babies now, that goes on for the rest of time.
Yes, this is intergenerational. The word I used to describe what happened in Fallujah is herbicide, the killing of a city. So this is slow violence. This is death over generations. The health problems in Fallujah have been deemed by one researcher as being higher in number than Hiroshima and Nagasaki following the atomic bombs there. So this is going to have an impact on this community for forevermore.
Now, you've just been to Fallujah, Donna. Tell us what you saw and what you did there. You've just returned.
Yeah, the city is trying to rebuild now. They breathed a big sigh of relief once the US troops withdrew. Certainly everything became easier for the people there when the troops left. So now there aren't these long, complicated checkpoints, et cetera. There's signs of rebuilding. There's still many damaged buildings around the city, though, even 8 years on it's been. There's pockmarks everywhere, damage to the roads, some buildings still in rubble. But in other places, the community is just trying to get on and rebuild. So it's still quite a strong regional centre. Fallujah City Hospital has been rebuilt. Well, it's actually a new hospital. It's the only new building in the town, really. And so, but there's a feeling of tension still in the air. Things are still uneasy. There's a lot of caution because there are foreign groups still around Fallujah who are opposing the Iraqi government, and they are still having attacks and bombings, etc., in the area. So there's still security issues and still tension in the air.
So what did you have anything to do with the patients, the doctors, the people? Did you see these abnormalities? What did you observe, Donna Mulhern, when you were in Fallujah recently?
Yes, well, I actually spent a week sleeping in Fallujah Hospital. I was invited by the director of the hospital to stay there, and so I spent all of my time a week. It was much longer than I expected because of the difficult situation. So I was very, very grateful to have a whole week spending all of my time in Fallujah Hospital. So I got to meet many families who are struggling with very, very sick children. I got to sit with them and talk and interview them. I filmed many of these interviews. I sat with the doctors and I followed them around. And each day in the maternity ward, I got to meet the babies that were born. And each day I was there, there was babies born with problems. And so I was able to see that. Another story I heard when I was there, someone mentioned in passing the situation of the computer guy, the IT guy who worked there. His name was Bashir. And they said even the men, you know, are feeling the weight of this because Bashir has lost 4 children. And I said, what? I couldn't believe it. He was such a young fellow. So I sat down with him and asked him about his story. Him and his wife are a young, healthy couple. And their first baby was born and lived for 5 minutes only. They tried again, and their second baby was born dead. They tried the third time, and the third baby was born dead. They tried the fourth time, and this was just this year, and the fourth baby was born and lived for 5 minutes.
Oh, dear.
They named him Mohammed, and me and Bashir and his wife, Marwan, we went to Fallujah Cemetery, and this is a cemetery that used to be a football stadium, as I mentioned, and we stood at the grave of their baby, Mohammed, for some time there, and I got to talk to them about how they felt. And I asked them if they were planning to have more children, and they said no, they couldn't go through this again. This is a young couple, a young, attractive, healthy couple with good jobs and, you know, all their life ahead of them, and their desire to have a family has just been destroyed. It was very sad visiting Fallujah Football Stadium come cemetery, because there are many small unmarked graves just with slabs of concrete put in the ground, and those are the dead baby graves. So there are many, there's a whole section of the cemetery which is just for the dead babies. This cemetery has about 3,500 to 4,000 graves at the moment, and all the graves from this stadium cemetery are connected in some way to the attacks in 2004. So I guess when we look back on it, we can count at 3,500 to 4,000 lives affected in that way.
That includes the babies?
Yes. Well, probably not all the babies, but the babies who were in there.
What people need to know is
that the babies would have been died and they've gone somewhere else.
When uranium shells hit a tank, the uranium is what's called pyrophoric. It burns so that up to 80% of a shell will burst into flame, producing tiny little particles less than 5 microns in diameter, small enough to be inhaled into the terminal air passages of the lung. It's an alpha emitter. It's a very, very potent mutagen. It mutates genes and kills cells. And it's a potent carcinogen. It causes cancer. And as a heavy metal, it's excreted through the kidneys, so it can cause either acute nephritis as it damages the kidney, or it can cause renal cancer, cancer of the kidney, or the bladder, because the urine collects in the bladder. But the other thing is, it is excreted in the semen. And the wives of returning servicemen in America, veterans who've been in Iraq, complain of burning semen. It burns the inside of their vaginas. But more than that, clearly, the uranium is mutating the genes in the sperm. So therefore, the babies being conceived are genetically abnormal, hence the high incidence of severe congenital anomalies. And also, the uranium gets into the water supply, it gets into the food, and so it could pass through the placenta into the developing embryo in the first trimester, which is when all the organs are formed, killing cells that are going to form various organs, hence the abnormalities that you're reporting, Donna.
That sounds like a description exactly of what's happening to these babies. And the main issue is the hospital is just overwhelmed. As you can imagine, it's just a hospital equipped to deal with the average problems of an average city. But this is not an average city, and so that's why a lot of the parents have to take their babies outside of Fallujah to Baghdad, and many have to take them overseas, outside of Iraq, perhaps to Jordan, Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, somewhere to get the care they need. There was another family I met whose little boy, Saif, was about 18 months old. He had a very enlarged head. He had water on the brain.
Hydrocephalus, it's
called. And he was very ill, and he'd been in and out of hospital, and the parents were so dedicated to finding him every care he needed. The day before I met them, they had been in Baghdad to see doctors, and the doctors said to them, just take him home to die.
Yeah.
They said, there's nothing more, just take him home to die. And this family, well, they said to me, we refuse that. They're going to just keep trying to give him the care that they can as long as they can. And, of course, this is very expensive for these families. They can't afford this medical care as well. They get their basic care provided in Fallujah, but once they go further afield, they're having to take on the cost themselves.
Well, the truth is, Donna, there's nothing you can do for hydrocephalus and the baby will die, but I can understand the love and care and attention and concern that those parents have.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you talk, I think, you know, so the people in Fallujah killed 3 men in Blackwater who are mercenaries, and in fact, now that America's leaving Iraq, there are going to be far more mercenaries, privately paid soldiers, paid by the Pentagon, private firms, still killing people than American soldiers, and that's going to keep going. So because the people in Fallujah got mad because these people were out there killing people and hung them on a bridge, the vengeance is almost unbelievable, isn't it, of the American government, Donna?
It is. It was unbelievable. When I was studying for my thesis on Fallujah, I was researching the rhetoric that was being used at the time, the discourse the words that were being used to describe this community, and it was just shocking that this was, one general said, Satan has a home. He lives in Fallujah, and we are going to seek him out.
Is that right?
So the whole of Fallujah is hell and Satan and evil. So the rhetoric that was used was I believe, deliberate, and it really set up a situation that justified then the attacks in the eyes of the general public. Because if these people were so evil and if they were barbarians, then this is what they deserved. And this was the sort of commentary coming from talkback radio hosts at the time. They compared it, as I did, with Rome's sacking of Carthage and the destruction of that civilization and the sowing of salt on the earth to contaminate the earth. There were commentators who were calling for the Carthage response to flatten the city and not allow it to exist anymore. And these were really serious commentators, and some of them were academics as well. And creating just this cultural violence, really, this rhetoric of violence that really was used therefore to justify these attacks. The entire city was basically dehumanized. And, of course, the other issue is the breaches of the Geneva Conventions. So we then ask, well, what rights did the people have to call upon the laws of war? For example, one of them being to flee the city as civilians without being hindered. But that was not granted to them and many others. So, again, why was there not outrage that the Geneva Conventions were breached? Well, I would suggest that the people were so dehumanized by this point that nobody believed they deserved these rights, because they were almost deemed to be subhuman and that they didn't actually deserve to have a coverage of international law. So,
yet what gets me is probably most of these blasted generals go to church and pretend they're Christians.
Well, I'm sure that's the case. So the hypocrisy is just astounding. The lack of consistency and the hypocrisy is truly shocking, because what we've had here is a city destroyed with impunity. And what I fear now is the implications that might have for any future military campaign.
Mm.
That if this was not condemned noisily, then what's going to happen next time? Which is why now we need to condemn it noisily, and we need to raise the outrage now looking back and seeing what's happened.
So, Donna, tell me about the sacking of Carthage, because I'm ignorant in my history. I don't know why Rome sacked Carthage. Can you give us a bit of background?
It's fascinating in its similarities. I didn't know anything about it either until I started reading up about it, because these right-wing political commentators kept mentioning Carthage.
Yeah.
So it was fascinating and, for me, a great tie-in. So Rome and Carthage are two powers back in this 200-300 BC.
Mm-hmm.
Rome is uncomfortable when Carthage is gaining in strength. And there was the First Phoenician War, which destroyed Carthage, well, flattened Carthage, and then they rebuilt. Then there was another war, and then there was... So this threat was always there. They were always like the enemy in the background, the enemy in inverted commas.
To Rome.
Yes. And there was a senator in Rome named Cato, and Cato the Elder, he was called. And he was obsessed with the perceived threat from Carthage. It was always there in the back of his mind as, the enemy is always there lurking, and they're always a threat to us, the Carthage threat. Mind you, Carthage was just a mercantile town. They were just business people. They weren't a warlike people, the Phoenicians. But Cato was obsessed, and he finished every speech he gave in the Roman Senate with the same words, no matter what the topic of the speech was. And the words were Carthago delenda est, which means Carthage must be destroyed. And for years he did this. And eventually he obviously convinced his fellow senators of this perceived evil and threat, and they launched a preemptive strike on Carthage. So Carthage had not done anything to provoke, but Rome went in.
Mm.
And after all this rhetoric, and they did flatten the city. It took a long time, but house to house, burning the city down. But the interesting thing about the sacking of Carthage is this myth that when the city burned, it was sowed with salt into the earth, and that that symbolised contamination and infertility so that the city could never rise again. Because, of course, when other cities were sacked, they could rebuild. Mm. So I found this image fascinating because it just tied in with the contamination
of the uranium.
Of modern weaponry. So this was Carthage became famous for that it was sowed with salt and became infertile, and so it never did rise again. And that culture, that was the last expression of that culture, the Phoenician culture. So the two comparisons for me was this: the rhetoric coming from Cato the Elder in dehumanising Carthage all that way, and then a preemptive strike, then destroying the city and sowing it with salt. So now go forward to 2004. And what we had was one particular, well, there were several right-wing commentators calling for the destruction of Fallujah, but one of them said, we must give Fallujah the Carthage treatment.
Who was that?
His name is Dr. Jack Wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
He's a former Reagan government advisor and a doctor of philosophy. And so, not just a guy on the radio, someone who had an audience and someone who was in many people's eyes credible.
Mm.
So he got hysterical about it, and he said we must follow the lead of Rome, and we must finish every sentence that we have, that we say, and every speech we give, and every email we write. He said we must finish it with the words "Fallujah delenda est." Fallujah must be destroyed.
Really?
I can't believe he said that. He said this. He wrote to every congressman and he said, you all must finish your speeches in Congress with the words, Fallujah must be destroyed.
Really?
Yes. You could imagine. This was very convenient for my thesis, but very disturbing to have that historical comparison so stark. And there were others who also called on the Carthage treatment and compared the sacking of Carthage. But he did it in such a precise way. And, he had a big audience. He has websites. He has I think, radio programs, and so this is why it was quite eerie to make that comparison with something that happened in the ancient world. And we often think of the ancient world as barbaric and not civilized. And yet what I argued in my thesis is that the result was the same as the sacking of Carthage and the sacking of Fallujah, and that is long-term intergeneration herbicide of a city.
Mm.
A form of slow violence. So we've got, babies dying from wounds of a war they never saw.
Mm.
Years later, this is the ancient orange of this war.
And so that's going to go on for hundreds of generations.
That's right. And perhaps Fallujah will die out one day as Carthage did.
Yes. Can you... So we've got 10 minutes left, Donna Mulhern. You wanted to address the issue of Iraq 9 years later after shock and awe.
Yeah, I just had some... I was quite shocked when I returned to Iraq. This was my fourth visit.
And you've just come back, right?
I've just come back a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And everything was worse than I expected it to be.
In what way?
It had been quite some years since I was there last, so I had expected improvement. Because in the conditions and in the appearance and in everything, because the billions of dollars of aid and reconstruction money that we hear about had been pumped into that country. And so I expected things to be more ordered and improving. But when I got there, it did feel like, generally throughout Baghdad, still a sense of anarchy. The streets were literally crumbling, the gutters falling apart, buildings being held together by ropes, just the garbage on the street, just a sense of the place being a basket case, really. It's the Baghdad that I had seen years before was just gone. It was, a feeling of fear and tension, of chaos. The poor people are coping with only 4 to 5 hours of electricity per day, and this was the same level as in 2003 and 2004. So after 9 years, there's been no improvement in the electricity. And this is the huge issue for the local people, because imagine summer temperatures of between 45 and 52 degrees without, you know, an air conditioner or a fan or a refrigerator. And so people are dying because of this heat exhaustion. Elderly and babies aren't coping. And the people just throwing their hands in the air and they're saying, 9 years, like, what is this? And what about the billions of dollars? Where has it gone? And, of course, we now know answers to that. It's been squandered. The corruption is rife. It's gone to US contractors. And just the sense of the city had just gone backwards, not forward. And many Iraqis said to me, Donna, they've bombed us back to the Dark Ages. That's what they're saying. They've bombed us back to the Dark Ages. So that's just the physical issues. Now, I haven't mentioned the society issues, and that is that their human rights have gone out the window if they were ever there. Like, there is very little freedom of speech. If you criticise al-Maliki's government, you are in trouble. There are, you know, secret chambers at the bottom of most police stations where people are questioned with, what do they say, interrogated, you know, enhanced interrogated techniques. There is no sense that there is in any way a democracy, because the current Prime Minister al-Maliki was not elected by the people. He got the second largest amount of votes, not the first, but, you know, in this trying to work out minority government who would govern, it took many months, and the US stepped in and appointed al-Maliki as the Prime Minister. So the people resent him because he was not elected by them. They say, you came to give us democracy, you gave us this. He's dictatorial in his manner. He's basically a client state of Iran. Iran is funding and influencing the decisions of the Iraqi government. And if it's not Iran, then it's the US still trying to have their influence. So the people just feel, what was all this for? This was all for nothing. We lost everything we had. Our safety, our sense of, at least they had a sense of well-being, that they could live their lives and get on with their lives and have an education and have good health care. And they said, we used to have one Saddam, Donna. They said, now we have hundreds of Saddams. That's both in terms of human rights violations and in terms of violence, because there's still a lot of violence going on, and the people blame, the US invasion and occupation for that violence. They said, even now, with the troops gone, they said before, under Saddam, they said, or before 2003, there was not a car bomb in the history of Iraq. There was never a car bomb. There was never a suicide bomb. And so when the Bremer came in and the US administration in the early days, and in their stupidity, sacked the entire Iraqi army and police force, then the people are still living the implications of that. The power vacuum that was then left, the lack of security, the floodgates were open, and for the first time now you have extremists in Iraq, Wahhabis and Salafists, coming in from Saudi Arabia and other countries who had never gained a foothold there before. And they are now trying to have their influence, and everyone's trying to have their influence, and the result is just chaos. And the people are just wishing for the old days, when they said, at least we knew we could survive. They said, we knew how to survive.
Yeah, and women had pretty good rights under Saddam. It's very interesting. We're out of time now, Donna, but I will say that I read some years ago that two countries in the Middle East with the lowest infant mortality and the highest rates of literacy were Iraq and Libya.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm.
So Iraq's been sacked. It's been sacked.
Yes, we can call it an herbicide, but a broader we can call it a sociocide, and that is the destruction of the social fabric of this nation.
Sociocide.
Iraqi people who were there before 2003 say, we do not recognise this place.
Yeah.
It is no longer the place that we know.
The same thing's happening in Afghanistan. You know, if the American people really knew this, I know them really well, they'd be absolutely shocked to their back teeth, but they don't get the information that you've just provided. So this interview is terribly important, Donna. I thank you so much for imparting this knowledge and also for you being a human shield and for your bravery and courage in the face of such evil, really. It's people like you who, like the Joan of Arcs, although she was a military person, but, you know, who give us some hope, I think, for the future.
Yeah, well, my goal and my mission is just to do what you said, to raise the awareness, because if people know, then they can respond and be outraged and call for accountability.
That's right. So
my goal is to raise that awareness.
I would encourage everyone listening to this interview to go to the website afterwards, ifyoulovethisplanet.org, and download this and get your friends and relatives to listen, because, you know, they might be conservative, but this is a truly conservative issue, to do the right thing and to conserve human life. So, Donna Mulhern, I thank you enormously for this spectacular interview today and great luck and for your future.
Thank you very much, Helen. Thank you.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Donna Mulhern, a former journalist, a political advisor and an author. Her book called Ordinary Courage is published by Murdoch Books. She obviously is an Australian. Thanks so much for listening today, everyone. I hope you learnt a lot. I hope you are shocked to your back teeth. I hope it stimulates and inspires you to be like Donna, to walk in her warm shoes of courage and commitment, to really practice goodness on earth. And I encourage you to listen again to the program next week, where we'll have another probably startling interview. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.